we had to take that into account in trying to figure out what to do at that stage once we had spread the message throughout the city and the country about the occupation and the issues involved. And so we chose at a certain point after getting a verbal commitment from the administration that if we left and if we they couldn't announce anything at the time, but if we left the hospital, that they would indeed build a new Lincoln Hospital. And they did build a new Lincoln Hospital shortly thereafter. But we then had to decide to either have a complete standoff and many people injured or hurt, or figure out a way to get out of the hospital while the police surrounded it. And I think Emma did a very good job in terms of telling the story of how that happened.
And it, that amazing
and that miraculously
escape.
No one was hurt. And we all managed to get out. No one was arrested.
And that amazing escape in white coats was incredible. Emma, we just have 10 seconds. How do people get to see this film at the Tribeca Film Festival and beyond?
You can watch it virtually. We are all of our screenings are sold out. So if you just go to the Tribeca website, Takeover 2021. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Emma Frances Snyder, director of the new short film, Takeover. It premieres Friday at the Tribeca Film Festival. And Juan, amazing. That does it for the show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Are you a fan of the independent film news and interviews on The Film Show? Well, you won't want to miss the new and expanded Words and Pictures, coming in 2019. That's right. The Film Show and Words and Pictures are coming together to fill the airwaves with the most creative happenings and fertile minds in screencraft, stagecraft, comics, and animation. So tune in to KBOO twice a month, 11:30 a.m. every second and fourth Thursday in 2019 and beyond, for the very best of the narrative arts on the new Words and Pictures.
Back home, folks.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, with over 66% of the state's adults vaccinated, Governor Kate Brown is hoping about 100,000 people will step up in order to reach the 70% vaccinated threshold. The city of Portland has reached a settlement with the family of Terrell Johnson, a young man killed by PPB officers in 2017. And in international news, a G7 agreement to change international tax laws could get thwarted by U.S. Republicans. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 9th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. The Oregon Health Authority reported 307 new cases of COVID-19 on Tuesday, bringing the overall number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 203,671. Oregon health officials also reported 6 new deaths, bringing the state's death toll to 2,670 people. There are currently 172 people hospitalized statewide, including 50 patients in intensive care with the virus. Governor Kate Brown said on Tuesday that Clackamas County is among 11 Oregon counties that will remain in the high-risk category when the new risk levels go into effect on Friday, June 11th. A county can move to the lower risk level once 65% of its adult residents have received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine and the county submits a vaccine equity plan. Both Multnomah and Washington counties have surpassed that threshold and already moved into the lower risk category. As of Monday, June 7th, Clackamas County has to vaccinate about 7,000 more residents before it becomes eligible to move down. Elsewhere in Oregon, Lane, Wasco, and Coos counties will move into the lower risk category on Friday, while Josephine and Yamhill counties will move into moderate risk. Southeastern Harney County is the only location in the state that will move backwards from low to moderate risk based on rising COVID-19 case levels. Once 70% of all Oregon residents 18 and older have received a first dose of the vaccine, Brown says she will lift most COVID-19 restrictions for the entire state. Oregon currently sits at a vaccination level of 66.8%, short about 107,000 people. Brown added yesterday, quote, Oregon is so close to more fully reopening our economy, but for unvaccinated individuals, COVID-19 remains as large a threat as it ever was. With more contagious variants spreading, far too many Oregonians are still being hospitalized when they could be protected with a vaccine. In neighboring Washington state, a new vaccine incentive, dubbed Joints for Jabs, will be taking place for a limited time until July 12th. Cannabis retailers in Washington will be allowed to host mobile vaccine clinics and offer adults 21 and older one free joint as a part of the deal. Local businesses have been offering promotions and incentives in the effort to get more people vaccinated, including entering to win a lottery or free alcoholic beverages and donuts. Nationally, the U.S. has reported more than 33.3 million cases of COVID-19. At least 597,000 people have died. Approximately half of the U.S. population has received at least one dose of a COVID vaccine, with 42% fully vaccinated. But the number of people getting vaccinated daily has continued to drop dramatically since April, even though half the population at this point remains unvaccinated. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has infected more than 174 million people. At least 3.7 million people have died across the world. The city of Portland has agreed to pay the family of Terrell Johnson $600,000 in a settlement for a wrongful death lawsuit brought against the city for his death. He was a 24-year-old man killed by a police officer in 2017. The settlement will allow the city to avoid having to defend a former Portland Police Bureau officer, Samson Agier, who killed Johnson. The settlement will also absolve the city and PPB of any guilt for his death. Johnson was killed in the evening of May 10, 2017, after experiencing a mental health crisis. Johnson had a utility knife on his person, and Agier, allegedly believing his life was in danger, shot Johnson 4 times in the chest and back. Johnson was pronounced dead at the scene. Agier was later cleared of any criminal charges on the basis of self-defense, and he never faced any internal discipline for his actions. He was even promoted to a PPB sergeant position in 2019, though he now works as a police officer in Boise, Idaho. Terrell's mother, Alicia Johnson, filed the wrongful death lawsuit against the city in May 2019. The lawsuit accuses Agier of failing to follow PPB's policy that prohibits officers from chasing someone on foot if they know the person is armed. The lawsuit alleges that the chase is what ultimately led to Johnson's death. The lawsuit also tied Johnson's death to PPB's record of disproportionately using force against folks who are perceived to be mentally ill, saying Agier failed to de-escalate a situation in which, quote, Mr. Johnson was clearly demonstrating signs of mental illness and distress. Portland City Council is expected to vote on the $600,000 settlement in July. It will be the second settlement resulting from a wrongful death case involving a PPB officer. In February, the city approved a $2.1 million settlement agreement with the family of Quanice Hayes, a 17-year-old person killed by a PPB cop in February of 2017, just 3 months before Johnson's death. Momentum is building for the campaign to recall Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler. Hundreds of volunteers are rallying to begin gathering the thousands of signatures required to begin the recall process on July 1st. Leaders of the Total Recall campaign criticized Wheeler for his large personal donations to his own campaign, his response to the Black Lives Matter protests in the summer of 2020, and the city's ongoing housing crisis. KBOO's Isabel Charlet spoke with Audrey Keynes, Total Recall's campaign manager, and John Schroeder, a volunteer with the group.
Your group has criticized Ted Wheeler for giving a large personal loan to his own campaign that you say violates campaign finance laws. Can you share more about that?
Yeah, so the campaign finance law that he violated was something that over 87% of Portlanders voted for. And so although the city auditor didn't choose to assign that as a violation, it is still something that the overwhelming majority of Portlanders demonstrated that they were in favor of, particularly just getting large personal money out of politics.
Your campaign also criticizes Wheeler for his response to the Black Lives Matter protests last summer, as well as his approach to the city's housing crisis.
Yeah, so Wheeler failed to address the completely legitimate concerns about police violence, and there were incredibly well-informed organizations, community leaders, as well as elected officials in his own administration that presented a series of solutions to police violence and look towards reform. And he was unresponsive to the solutions that were presented to him, and he failed to actually take any responsibility and do anything that was going to alleviate that as an issue for us in the city. And as far as housing goes, Portland gave Wheeler the funds and the green light to create affordable housing. And because of a lack of solutions that he's generated, it's now forced untold numbers of folks to sleep without shelter on the streets. And as a part of that also, there's been a breakdown of basic city services. So all in all, there's been plenty of solutions and plenty of paths forward, and he's chosen not to take them. Overall, he's definitely shown himself to be somebody who doesn't listen and doesn't understand that he represents the people who voted him into office. And I think a most recent one was the Portland Street Response, where there was a large number of Portlanders who were very in support of funding that, and he chose not to.
Yeah, I think that point is really important. I'm a veteran, and so, you know, leadership really matters to me. And the leaders I felt safest with and who I trusted the most in some really scary situations, the ones I trusted with my life, are the leaders who listened. Wheeler has proved time and time again that he just doesn't care what the community wants. He's going to do what he thinks best, regardless of what experts think, regardless of what everyday people think. I find that really frustrating.
The recall effort can't begin until elected officials have been in office for at least 6 months. And for Ted Wheeler, that starts on July 1st. What is your strategy to get those 50,000 signatures you need?
I just want to say that there's a lot of community support already, and we have over 200 volunteers already working with us who are driving this effort forward. We are supporting the signature gathering process, and it'll be door to door. It'll be in places of business that folks frequent. And they're all prepared to talk about all the failures that Wheeler has done over the course of his term and his past term.
Yeah, I think people are going to be excited to be a part of a monumental expression of democracy in Portland's history. I think this is an incredible movement, and I think people are ready for it and passionate about it.
Oregon City recently recalled their mayor just last year. I'm curious if there's any lessons that your campaign has gleaned from that successful effort.
And that was about the same time that I think there were other recalls around the country that were gaining steam, and it was just encouraging.
How do you respond to people who may be critical of the recall effort and say, you know, oh, he won fair and square, you're just being poor sports?
Yeah. I mean, first and foremost, he did not win by a majority of the vote. He only got 46% of the vote, which very clearly demonstrates that people weren't excited about him, and a majority of Portlanders did not vote for him or want him in office. The other piece is that this is a democratic tool, and this is something that is for us to be able to use when we know that the leader that's been elected is not doing the job that was asked of them.
Yeah, I think that anyone who's paying attention to national politics right now is aware of how important it is not just to vote, but to stay engaged in the democratic process. I think that this is one of the ways that we can do that. We can demonstrate a commitment to democracy by holding leaders accountable when they don't follow the will of the people.
I've been speaking with Audrey Keynes, the campaign manager for the Recall Ted Wheeler campaign, as well as John Schroeder, a volunteer for that campaign. And I'm Isabel Charlet for KBOO News.
More information on the effort to recall Ted Wheeler is found online at totalrecallpdx.com. That was KBOO's Isabel Charlet. At the Bybee Lakes Hope Center, formerly known as the Wapato Jail, unhoused Portlanders who stay sober can get 3 meals a day and a curtained-off bed for $250 a month. The center currently houses about 45 residents per night. Ellen Evans is the chief executive of Helping Hands Reentry Outreach Centers, the nonprofit that operates the facility. He's happy with how the effort to house more Portlanders is going, saying, quote, "They said it couldn't be done, and that's what I like about it." In April, the Oregon legislature passed a bill that helped fund the former jail's transformation with a $2 million investment and with the personal leadership of State Senator Betsy Johnson of Scappoose, who's also a co-chair of the Joint Ways and Means Committee. Both Johnson and the other co-chair, Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward of Portland, sit on the Bybee Lakes Hope Center Advisory Board. Multnomah County has attempted to provide services at the locations where unhoused people live in order to meet their physical needs, as well as treat substance abuse and mental health concerns. But Bybee Lakes, which receives funding from the county and the state, takes an old-fashioned approach, requiring people to live there, be sober, pay rent, and enroll in what's called a reentry program. Multnomah County Board Chair Deborah Kafouri acknowledged the different approaches. Kafouri said, quote, "I appreciate that folks across the private sector continue to step up because it's going to take all of us coming together to end homelessness in our community." In 2018, real estate magnate Jordan Schnitzer obtained the property after another business owner bought it from the county for $5 million. With drought already gripping the Pacific Northwest and signs this summer could bring even more wildfires, advocates are worried about salmon, a species already on the brink of extinction, particularly in the Columbia River Basin. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
There are signs this summer could be a bad one for the native salmon of the Northwest. Already, drought has gripped the region, causing low river flows that could be hard for fish to navigate or spawn in. That's bad news for species already teetering on extinction, especially in the Columbia River Basin. Betsy Emery with the Association of Northwest Steelheaders says a study this year from the Nez Perce tribe predicts 77% of Snake River Chinook salmon will be nearly extinct in 4 years if current trends hold.
Our salmon runs cannot afford one catastrophic event that can really devastate the potential for salmon recovery. And so far we're seeing a lot of red flags that indicate we could see a catastrophic event like that this summer.
More than 70% of Oregon is experiencing drought considered severe or worse, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife says March and April were among the driest since the 1890s, with many streams at 25% of their typical flow for this time of year. Emery says wildfire is another concern, which can cause poor water stream quality. While wildfires have the potential to improve quality in the long run, Emery says the endangered fish might not have that much time. She notes humans can't improve habitat for salmon overnight and have little control over drought or changing ocean patterns because of climate change.
The only thing that we have immediate action and control over is the function and existence of the Lower Snake River dams. There is significant science that connects those dams to hot water and devastating mortality for the salmon that are swimming through.
She says the dams are especially harmful for the juvenile salmon that pass through them. Idaho Congressman Mike Simpson proposed a plan for the region that includes breaching the Snake River dams, but elected leaders in Oregon and Washington have sidelined it. However, Emery says they've kept dam breaching on the table. She adds what's important right now is that leaders identify a clear pathway to salmon recovery.
The clock is ticking. We do not have time for some sort of lengthy process. We need an aggressive timeline that provides funding for the bold actions that we need to take.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Noise Filter, Debunking COVID-19. We'll follow that up at 5:45 with News from the Boo, your look at what's happening inside KBOO, with co-interim station manager Jenna Yokoyama. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 49 degrees. Tomorrow, we can expect mostly cloudy skies with a high of 69. Nice. Today in history, in 2004, Brian Williamson died. Williamson was a Jamaican gay rights activist known for co-founding JFLAG, the Jamaican Forum for Lesbians, All Sexuals, and Gays. He was one of the earliest openly gay men in Jamaican society and one of its best-known gay rights activists.
Thank you.
25 richest billionaires in the United States paid a true federal tax rate of just 3.4% between 2014 and 2018, all while adding over $400 billion to their collective wealth. That's from an investigative report released earlier this week by ProPublica. Tesla founder Elon Musk, the second richest person on the planet, paid no federal income taxes in 2018, while billionaire George Soros paid no federal income taxes 3 years in a row. Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, the world's richest man, and Berkshire Hathaway CEO Warren Buffett paid a true tax rate of 0.1%. ProPublica makes clear that these low payments are not due to elaborate tax dodging schemes, saying, quote, "It turns out billionaires don't have to evade taxes exotically and illicitly. They can avoid them routinely and legally. Their wealth derives from the skyrocketing value of their assets, like stock and property. Those gains are not defined by U.S. laws as taxable income unless and until the billionaires sell," end quote. The report increases calls for tax reform, like the wealth tax recently proposed by Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. President Joe Biden has cut off infrastructure talks with Republicans. With more on that story and its implications, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The country's wealthiest, who profited immensely during the pandemic, have not been paying their fair share.
Senate Finance Chair Ron Wyden spoke out after leaked IRS documents show that the super wealthy, including Amazon founder Jeff Bezos and Tesla CEO Elon Musk, paid a true tax rate of just 3.4% between 2014 and 2018. The IRS is investigating the leak by ProPublica. Infrastructure talks are officially off between President Joe Biden and a group of GOP senators. Biden offered to reduce his plan by more than $1 trillion, but Republicans would only increase their proposal by $150 billion. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says a bipartisan group of senators is still negotiating.
It may well be that part of the bill that'll pass will be bipartisan, and part of it will be through reconciliation, but we're not going to sacrifice the bigness and boldness in this bill.
Biden's first nominee to the federal bench, Julia Neils, was confirmed for the U.S. District Court in New Jersey. Senators also approved Regina Rodriguez for the Federal District Court in Colorado. The Senate passed a sweeping bill to combat China's competitiveness. It would set aside $250 billion for research grants, boost semiconductor manufacturing, and target security threats. A House opioid crisis hearing looked into the role of the family behind the company that created the addictive painkiller OxyContin.
It's imperative that we hold the Sacklers accountable, but it's also imperative that we build systems that support Black and brown people, systems that prioritize the needs of communities over the greed of corporations.
Congresswoman Cori Bush called for improved access to addiction treatment, and Alexis Plus, who lost her son to opioid addiction, scolded Republicans who argued about the need to stem the flow of illegal drugs coming into the U.S. from Mexico.
It's stunning to me that this committee has an opportunity to hold the greatest family cartel in the history of the United States and possibly the world responsible for what they've done. And yet here you are distracting from your opportunity.
Meanwhile, in Mexico, Vice President Kamala Harris said she'll work with the country to improve economic opportunities in Central America to address the root causes of migration.
I look forward to engaging in diplomacy with government, with private sector, with civil society, and the leaders of each in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras.
Harris was criticized for not yet visiting the U.S.-Mexico border, where record numbers of migrants are arriving.
Imagine calling 911 when your home is on fire and watching as they hose down your neighbor's house instead. That's what it feels like watching the vice president down in Central America.
That's Texas Republican Senator John Cornyn, who is promoting his bipartisan Border Solutions Act. It would expedite the asylum process, create regional border processing centers, and improve access to legal services and other resources. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
Lawmakers in Congress have reintroduced a bill they say would help ensure nationwide access to safe abortions. The reintroduction of the bill comes as abortion rights are being challenged in multiple states across the country. Michaela Savitt has more.
Lawmakers in Congress have reintroduced a bill they say would ensure access to safe abortions across the country, just as abortion rights are being challenged with a strict Mississippi law that will be reviewed by the U.S. Supreme Court in 2022. The Women's Health Protection Act would allow for abortions in every state to happen without restrictions that aren't medically necessary. Florida Congresswoman Lois Frankel, who co-introduced the bill, says unnecessary restrictions include waiting periods or having to travel a far distance to get care due to clinic shutdowns.
These restrictions are designed to control and criminalize women and or their providers. They steal from women the ability to make the important life-changing decision of if and when to start a family. And it is a violation of their rights and their basic humanity.
In a survey released in January, 68% of respondents said they believe the constitutional right to abortion should be protected. And an Institute for Women's Policy research study notes there would be more Florida women in the workforce if restrictions were lifted. As of Tuesday, no GOP legislators are co-sponsors of the bill. From 2007 to 2016, pregnancy-related deaths were 2 to 3 times more prevalent among Black women in the U.S., according to the CDC. Danielle Hurd Wilson, with the group Unite for Reproductive and Gender Equity, asserts access to reproductive care is also an issue of racial and economic justice.
Young people and Black, Indigenous, and people of color should be able to get abortion care free from unnecessary restrictions such as mandatory ultrasounds, waiting periods, and others that shame, stigmatize, and deny us timely, confidential abortion care.
In the last decade, almost 500 state laws restricting abortion have passed in legislatures around the country. I'm Michaela Savitt for Public News Service.
A new report has found that the true number of Indigenous deaths from the coronavirus pandemic may never be known, and the lack of data may impact future access to resources for tribal communities. With that story and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News, the daily newscast to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick, in for Antonia Gonzalez. The number of American Indian and Alaska Native people who have died during the coronavirus pandemic may never be known. A group of Native journalists found that health privacy laws and breakdowns in local, state, federal, and tribal data reporting systems contributed. As Christine Trudeau reports, this concerns tribal health advocates, who say the lack of data impacts resources for tribal communities.
Reporters with the Indigenous Investigative Collective made multiple public records requests for death records in an effort to find a reliable fatality count. Those requests were rejected, citing privacy. The collective has found data problems exist nationwide. As of June 2nd, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that more than 6,500 American Indians and Alaska Natives have died from COVID-19, the highest rate of any ethnic group in the U.S. That estimate likely falls far short of the actual death toll. The Urban Indian Health Institute in Seattle, Washington, is one of 12 nationally recognized tribal epidemiology centers. Director Abigail Echohawk.
Even though right now we're showing as having some of the highest death rate, it's a gross undercount.
That undercount leaves researchers and epidemiologists completely in the dark when creating practices and policies to deal with future pandemics. Tracking Indigenous COVID-19 patients accurately would involve the entire health system, including the Indian Health Service, tribal facilities, urban Indian health programs, private clinics, and other non-IHS facilities. Elizabeth Fowler, acting IHS director, says they're not tracking COVID-19 deaths because they want to avoid underreporting.
We rely and use the information that's reported by CDC.
That lack of good information can make things difficult for tribal nations. Carolyn Angus Hornbuckle with the National Indian Health Board says nations need real-time accurate data to protect their citizens.
We are not capturing all of the impacts, and we are not capturing all of the deaths for American Indians and Alaska Natives. The true picture is actually worse than what the data tells us.
For Echohawk, the omission of data on Native communities contributes to the elimination of Native people in the public eye, and it aids the federal government in abandoning treaty laws and trust responsibilities. I'm Christine Trudeau.
This story is produced by the Indigenous Investigative Collective, a project of the Native American Journalists Association. A new poll finds a majority of Canadians blame the Catholic Church for the abuses and deaths of children at residential schools. The Nelson Star reported the survey by the Association for Canadian Studies was conducted about a week after ground-penetrating radar found what's believed to be the remains of 215 children at a former residential school in Kamloops, British Columbia. More than 150,000 First Nations, Métis, and Inuit children were forced into these schools, which were government-funded and often operated by the church. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who's Catholic, asked Pope Francis to consider an apology during a 2017 Vatican visit. CTV News reports a petition on change.org has garnered over 3,500 signatures demanding the church apologize and pay $20 million in restitution to survivors of residential schools. It also calls for the church to pay for reinterment of the bodies found in British Columbia and for church records on the schools to be open to Indigenous communities. Also, the BBC reported at Ryerson University in Toronto this week, protesters toppled a statue of Egerton Ryerson, the man considered the architect of the residential school system, and there are calls to change the name of the university. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael would rather act than react.
Don't give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. Kamala Harris, the daughter of immigrants, told Guatemala, Mexico, and their neighbors, don't come, stay and suffer the consequences you didn't cause, as we suffer the consequences of Trump, of the richest paying 3% of their income in taxes. We'll see what the climate consequences of global warming, a dry spring and a drier summer, bring to burst upon us. Fire, famine, infestation, while COVID sits back and mutates. The truth is no surprise, only we keep forgetting every action has reactions, not always equal and opposite, sometimes unpredictable, sometimes years away. Keep your eyes and heart open, follow your momentum, and be ready to bounce. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 9th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael and Isabel Charlet. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Megan Kamrick, Michaela Savitt, Mary Sherman, and Eric Tegedoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for COVID Noise Filter.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
All right, welcome to Noise Filter. This is Dr. Mark Allen Derry. Doc Griggs is not able to be with us today, so let's go ahead and get started. Herd immunity is unlikely. Now, the phrase herd immunity was never spoken more than at the beginning of the pandemic when public health officials said that reaching herd immunity would put an end to the coronavirus disruption in our lives. Now, there is widespread consensus among scientists and public health experts that reaching herd immunity is not attainable, not in the foreseeable future, and maybe not ever. According to the New York Times, the virus will most likely become a manageable threat that will continue to circulate in the United States for years to come, still causing hospitalizations and deaths, but in much smaller numbers. An evolutionary biologist at Emory says, the virus is unlikely to go away, but we want to do all we can to check that it's likely to become a mild infection. Also, there are a couple reasons why the threshold for herd immunity will almost be impossible to reach. Reason number one, early on in the pandemic, the target herd immunity threshold was estimated to be about 60 to 70% of the population. But as vaccines were developed, estimates of that threshold began to rise. That's because the initial calculations were based on the contagiousness of the original version of the virus. The predominant variant that is now circulating in the United States is about 60% more transmissible than the original. As a result, experts now calculate the herd immunity threshold to be at least 80%. And if even more contagious variants continue to develop, and they will, or if scientists find that immunized people can still transmit the virus, the calculation will have to be revised again, upwards. The second reason we may never reach herd immunity is unfortunately because of vaccine hesitancy. Polls show that 30% of the U.S. population are still reluctant to be vaccinated. That number is expected to improve, but probably not enough. Another reason for not reaching herd immunity is the connectivity between countries, particularly as travel restrictions ease, which further emphasizes the urgency of protecting everyone globally. We will not achieve herd immunity as a country or a state or even a city until we have enough immunity in the population as a whole, says Lauren Ansel Myers, the director of COVID-19 Modeling Consortium at the University of Texas at Austin. So, in conclusion, continued immunizations, especially for people at the highest risk of age, exposure, or health status, will be crucial to limiting the severity of outbreaks. If the vaccination levels of the most vulnerable groups continue to rise, the expectation is that over time, the coronavirus may become seasonal like the flu, affecting mostly the young and the healthy. Failure of plasma treatment teaches lesson in science and crisis. You know, in the early stages of the pandemic, plasma from people with COVID antibodies was oft touted as a possible treatment for COVID-19 without much evidence that this was the case. But now, according to the New York Times, the federal government acted on this possibility anyway, pouring $800 million into the collection effort. Mayo Clinic and the Red Cross led campaigns to get that plasma. Now more than a year into the pandemic, no quality evidence of the plasma's effectiveness against COVID-19 has been found, and demand for plasma has dropped and collections have slowed down. According to the Times, the lack of return of this massive gamble from the U.S. government is an important lesson in experimental treatment during crises. The government administered plasma outside of the parameters of a clinical trial, making it very time-consuming to measure effectiveness. Now, when researchers were able to reach a conclusion, it wasn't promising. While plasma may be helpful to COVID patients under certain conditions, it didn't have much broadly applicable effect, especially for more severe cases. And in August, the FDA's commissioner misrepresented these preliminary findings after the agency authorized plasma for emergency use, making the treatment appear as if it had more efficacy than it actually did. This opened up the treatment more widely. Community hospitals with scarce resources and few alternative options adopted the practice for its greater availability. And when hospitals saw that the treatment was unlikely to succeed, they needed to treat patients in a way that they could. Some scientists, including those who worked for the FDA under previous administrations, want the FDA to rescind authorization for this treatment. According to the former chief scientist of the agency, pandemic exceptionalism, where typical scientific practices are abandoned due to the crisis, serve to do more harm than good, wasting resources and diverting time and labor away from researching other treatments. Increase in COVID cases among young adults. Contrary to popular belief, COVID-19 does impact people of all ages, both young and old. And in recent months, cases for young adults have been on the rise. While much of the at-risk population was initially of older ages, hospitals are beginning to experience a shift in patient population with greater number of young and middle-aged adults. So today, across the U.S., adults under the age of 50 represent the most hospitalized patients at 35% of hospital admissions. Next, people between the ages of 50 and 64 years old make up the second highest proportion, 31%. And at the same time, hospital admissions for people over the age of 65 have decreased dramatically. Though About 30% of the U.S. population was fully vaccinated by May. A vast majority of the vaccinated population is over the age of 65 due to early prioritization. Another factor to consider is the Alpha variant of COVID-19. It has quickly become the dominant strain of the virus, and it's 40 to 70% more contagious. Thus, we're seeing way more younger people in the hospitals with more severe infections of the disease. We cannot stress this enough, that this is not over. There's still some ways to go, and we as a country remain at risk for severe consequences. It is important that everyone, vaccinated or not, continue to abide by COVID safety guidelines enforced by the CDC. We must take this seriously and act accordingly. A return to the Roaring Twenties. Now, as vaccination rates increases, most Americans are excited to return to some degree of normalcy. On social media, some have anticipated a roaring 2020s, similar to the frivolity that came at the end of the 1918 influenza pandemic and World War I. According to Politico, however, the aftermath of the COVID pandemic is unlikely to be as dramatic. While the consensus used to be that the boom of the Roaring Twenties was due solely to the end of the war, some historians now think that the pandemic also played a large role. According to the Washington Post, the role it played may not have been as conscious, as the flu itself was ravaging the population without being spoken about outside of public health circles. Now, this lack of coverage meant that when the 1918 pandemic was over, it was quickly forgotten or tucked away in the minds of the public. But according to the Post, this is much less likely to happen with COVID. First, dying of infectious diseases was massively common in 1918, and today we are more likely now to die of old age. Secondly, today's access to the internet keeps us far more informed of the magnitude of the event. The pandemic now feels like any unlikely global phenomenon. So, according to Politico, the 1918 flu also differed from COVID-19 in that it disproportionately killed younger Americans, whose survival contributed to a live hard mentality. Because COVID mostly affects older people, its end may not elicit the same reality. One thing that holds true across both pandemics is that the virus will not just disappear. According to Politico, this means it is vitally important to learn from pandemics past in order to manage current and future ones. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Dr. Derry and I have a daily show at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time, where we go into more detail on stories and answer your questions about COVID-19.
You can find Doc Griggs at DocGriggs1 on social media, and you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Derry or at DRDERY. You can follow us at NoiseFilter on Instagram, NoiseFilterNola on Twitter, and for more information about us and the show, you can go to NoiseFilterShow.com. Hey, Doc Griggs, any last words?
Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO, with news from your community radio station.
Well, good evening. You are listening to News from the Boo here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Jenny Yokoyama, your host for News from the Boo, and I'm also one of KBOO's interim station co-managers. Here on News from the Boo, we talk about all things KBOO. So let's dig in and see what's going on at KBOO. We have some special programming coming up this month for Juneteenth weekend. We have a couple of special days of programming. On Saturday, June 19th, KBOO will be live streaming the 49th annual Juneteenth Oregon Celebration. And that'll be live streaming from the Jack London Review from 1 to 7 p.m. right here on KBOO. Juneteenth Oregon, in collaboration with PDX Jazz, will be
bringing you music, art, and entertainment to celebrate Juneteenth recognition as an official state holiday here in Oregon. So again, that's on Saturday, June 19th from 1 to 7 p.m. right here on KBOO. So tune those radio dials or go onto our website, kboo.fm, or even use our mobile app. There's even a special appearance by KBOO's own Mike Crenshaw. Then the next day on June 20th, that's Sunday, KBOO will be having a soul and hip-hop marathon. So lots of good programming next weekend. Then on June 26th and 27th, from 3 to 7 p.m. is our live stream of this year's Good in the Hood. This is one of those annual events that are always heard on KBOO every year, so tune in. Again, that's June 26th and 27th from 3 to 7 p.m. here on KBOO. There's going to be music. It's going to be art, all the good stuff that always happens at Good in the Hood. Then on that following weekend, from Friday, July 2nd, all the way through Monday, July 5th, KBOO will be doing our annual broadcast of the Waterfront Blues Festival. The Waterfront Blues Fest is back with live performances. They're down by the waterfront again. It's a little upriver. And if you're used to tuning in to KBOO and hearing all-day broadcasts, it's going to be a little bit different this year. This year, we'll be doing a live broadcast from the waterfront from 12 p.m. to 4 p.m. all 4 days, because the festival organizers are trying to accommodate as many people as possible at the festival this year. So they're kind of doing like a matinee and then an evening performances, so the morning performers are the exact same acts that you'll see during the evening show. So KBOO will be live broadcasting that matinee show there in the afternoon from 12 to 4 p.m. So tune in. It'll be just like we always do. We'll have some